Hello, and welcome to another episode of Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host. I've got two repeat guests with me here today. If you want to quickly introduce yourselves.
I'm Kirsty from Humanum. I'm the Outreach and Education Specialist at Humanum.
I'm Anita Cager, also from Humanum. I'm the Community Support Specialist.
Great. And Kirsty forgot to say she is also...
I'm also an intern for Marriage and Family Therapy at Lighthouse Center for Therapy and Play.
There we go. That's important. Okay, so we are going to be celebrating / educating about National PTSD Awareness Month, which is June. And so that's our topic for today. So really quickly, content warning. We will be talking about different traumatic experiences, the symptomology, light substance use, and a little bit of suicidality. So just content warning for you now. And so I'm going to hand it over to Kirsty. What's the 411 on PTSD?
All right. PTSD stands for post-traumatic stress disorder. It is a psychiatric disorder that can occur in people who have experienced or witnessed a traumatic event. There are 7 to 9% of Americans who will have PTSD in their lifetime, and females are 2 times more likely than males to experience PTSD. There's also a 2-to-1 ratio for those who are in poverty to experience PTSD over those who are wealthy. So to clarify more on the women being 2 times more likely to experience PTSD, this is where you want to think about domestic violence and sexual assault and just violence within the family. And this is also where you can think about the Me Too movement.
And I think, you know, we also probably are seeing men being underdiagnosed with this disorder as well. But we do know that women in general, and we're not even getting into the LGBTQIA population because we don't have enough time. But go listen to the LGBTQ episode if you're curious. So, you know, I think we're in a patriarchy, right? And so it's more likely that women will be victims within the patriarchy, and men are less likely to go seek out help. So maybe they are diagnosed with alcoholism or something else, but they're not truly sharing the PTSD. So we might see an underdiagnosing of men, and certainly women are more likely to be victims. So I think that's
a great women are more likely to talk about what they're going through.
Right. They're going to seek out help, I think, a little bit more than men will. Okay. So before we go a little bit further, we're going to break it down biology style here. So, Anita.
So, you know, our body has all these awesome systems that, you know, go on. So it's important to talk about our nervous system when it comes to PTSD, specifically the autonomic nervous system. I know you guys probably heard of, like, fight or flight. Like, you know, you out in the woods and you see a bear and you got to fight, flight, or freeze. Well, that's where some of this comes into play. Specifically, the sympathetic nervous system comes into play. That gets excited by dangerous situations, like I said. Just you happen to be in the woods, you see a bear, your heart's going to start racing, some other changes are going to have, you're going to be easily aroused, some fear is going to come into play as well. So overall, the sympathetic nervous system is in charge of our body's unconscious functions. Then we also have our parasympathetic nervous system. So that's what the system that helps make our body more normalized with the functions that take place. So that controls our digestion, salivation, urination, some other things. But, you know, you can figure that out. I remember in school, I always knew that as the rest and digest system. So with that being said, another important thing to know is our HPA, also known as our hypothalamic pituitary adrenal pathway. Say that 3 times for me. So that's basically the central stress response system in our body. And when a person perceives stress, that's when the HPA is activated. So we have this thing, our hypothalamus, that is signaled by the pituitary gland, and that's going to stimulate the adrenal cortex to actually release something called cortisol. So that's something that happens under times of stress. A fun fact, cortisol is actually passed through generations, and that can lead to our multi-transgenerational trauma as well.
If you want more information on that, it's really fascinating. So basically what happens if I experience a traumatic event, my cortisol is elevated, then my children naturally will have higher levels of cortisol. That's something that I've experienced for a long time before having children. So there's a really cool TED Ed talk that's animated, and it's got like little cartoon mice. And it's called How Stress Affects the Brain, if you want to look that up. And I love to show that. I think it's really neat. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a newish topic in the psychology world that we're talking about, transgenerational or multi-generational trauma. So it's pretty interesting. So really quickly, before we go on, you may have listened to our earlier podcast last year about anxiety. And so it's really important to know that stress, anxiety, trauma, it's all part of a spectrum. There is regular old state anxiety because there's a situation you're in that's kind of like, I'm a little nervous, like a job interview, right? Like most of us are going to be a little nervous about that, or a big test, or your first date, or, you know, hopefully not your 10th date. But anyway, so, you know, there's situations that are naturally kind of stressful or anxiety producing. And then, you know, we're talking about the other side of the spectrum today, which is acute stress disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, disassociation, depersonalization. We're not going to get into those last two today. We don't have enough time. But we are going to be talking about the traumatic side of the spectrum. So with that being said, I believe Kirsty is going to explain the difference for us.
So there are two kinds of stresses. We have acute stress, which is usually under a month, and also the post-traumatic stress disorder, which is PTSD. And that's what happens when that acute stress lasts longer than 1 month. So 80% of acute stress turns into PTSD.
Mm. And I think it's important to note that after, and we're going to cover this in 1 second, but after any traumatic experience, it's really normal to have reactions because you just witness something scary, whether to yourself or somebody else. And so it's really normal to be shaky because your sympathetic nervous system or your HPA pathway is kicked in. And so we're not saying that acute stress disorder necessarily needs treatment because it's typically like a couple weeks. You'll typically have like a peak. Maybe it's not that day because you're in shock, but it'll be a couple days later that all of a sudden you're like, whoa, I am a mess. And that's fine. But once we're talking about a couple of weeks, and we're going to talk about symptoms in a second, but once we're talking about weeks or months, that's when you really need to be seeking out some extra help. Okay, so what is trauma? So first, it's very subjective. Mm-hmm. Anita has a great example that she gives about car accidents.
So let's say Julie and I are driving down the 95 South, just to be specific. And let's just say, you know, we get in a car accident. Maybe I was a driver, and after that, I'm okay, you know, I can still drive after that and be okay, but Julie was my passenger side, but after that, she may never be able to set foot in a car again, so it's always different for everybody.
Yeah, and I love that you pointed out you were driving, because I think that's a great way to encapsulate kind of the nature of trauma. Mm-hmm. So trauma is typically a loss of perceived control over a situation combined with perceived threat to self or others. And so we're going to give you a bunch of examples. So again, content warning right here. Mm-hmm. So the car accident is a great one because you were driving in this scenario. So I did not have control in this scenario. So that could be why. Or on the flip side, maybe somebody just hit us and we're both a hot mess.
Right.
And now everybody needs therapy.
Can go anywhere.
So what are some other examples of trauma that you guys want to share?
One that I actually experienced at my internship is I had a young kid come in, and he had been through some physical assault from his, or physical abuse from his mother. And his way of dealing with it was he hid it. Like, he didn't want to talk about it. I asked him the situation, and he gave me all these stories about what happened, and none of them matched up to what I had known to happen. So I just think that that experience he went through, I don't know if he, like, wanted to put it in the back of his mind, but he also was happy to be in his new situation and scared to go back into his old one.
Last episode was scary math and sexual violence. So sexual violence is obviously a pretty huge traumatic experience. They have specific syndromes just for that. So rape trauma syndrome, which we're not going to get into today. But I think it's quite interesting that I'm sure, well, actually all three of us, when we were talking about this, you know, and that ratio of like women to men, I think we all incorrectly have the notion that it's just veterans, and that's absolutely not true. It's much higher prevalence outside of our armed forces and military because of some of the other stuff like sexual violence, physical assault or physical abuse.
Natural disasters.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of my favorite videos is this lady who thought her sister was in the towers on 9/11. Mm. And she just has this incredible story. And, you know, it's just really interesting because, again, this is a great example of like loss of control and perceived threat, mm-hmm. you know, not to yourself. Right. So you're so worried about your family members or a friend, or perhaps you witnessed a car crash. You're just minding your own business on the sidewalk and you watch something happen. That can be incredibly traumatic. Mass shootings or shooting events. I just recently, so I'm not sure if you guys know about this, but the Arundel Mills Mall had a shooting. Mm-hmm. I was at the mall and I was like, what the heck? Because this is the second time that I've been somewhere that there's been an active shooter. And I was like, well, obviously here I am today. I'm fine. But like, goodness gracious, at one point do I start to feel like a bad penny or something? Like, and so, you know, it just, it's interesting. News, especially now because it's so, oh man, news. Okay. So a lot of news channels like to sensationalize things and they just go on and on. They show gory images and like none of that's really helpful for anybody. So you can actually become traumatized by watching things happen to other people, not even in person. Definitely. But yeah.
Especially I live in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. So I see so much of that on the news and I'm just like, I can be walking to my car. You never know. Yeah. Mind you, I live in a quieter neighborhood, mm-hmm. but anything can happen. Anyone can just walk down your street. And I also got the Ring app where I get updates about what's going on around me.
Yeah.
And at least four times a week there's a shooting. Oh, and yeah. I'm just like, that is so scary. That's around me. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, I just perceived lack of control, perceived threat of harm, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because, like we said before, it's really subjective. So, you know, I have been through two shooting incidents and I was really starting to think about that for this episode. I was like, wait a second, hold on. And so, you know, there's that. I talked to, oh my gosh, our first responders, of course, if you're in war, I mean, they're just at a much higher risk rate of developing it than the average population because they're in uncontrollable, scary situations. And so, you know, I've talked to cops and some of them, I'm like, are you seeing anybody? Here's some therapy information. And then on the flip side, there's something called secondary trauma. So that's something where if you work with a ton of people that have been traumatized and you hear these stories and you feel like you can't help them and it's just so horrifying and, you know, you feel stuck. So that's also something that's really prevalent in, they call them compassion workers. So like nurses and social workers, therapists, all those people that do the dirty work, so to speak, of cleaning up from traumatic events and stuff in the people, not just actual cleaning although I suppose that could be traumatic as well. Right. And, you know, like Kirstie said, really anytime, anywhere, not to scare you all. I don't want you to leave traumatized from this episode. But, you know, we truly don't have control over a lot of situations. And so that's why it can be really scary. We like to be in control. I don't want stuff to go that way. I want it to go this way, you know. So, you know, speaking about rape, and again, we won't go into it too much because we talked about it last episode. But, you know, I think one of the most impactful experiences I had working directly with clients is that I had this young lady come in for an intake appointment. So those are normally about like 2 hours or so. We just cover all of everything about their whole life. No big deal. Hello, nice to meet you. Right. Tell me everything about you. How much do you weigh? You know, tell me about third grade, like, you know, everything about them. And we only have like three little questions that are just to check about potential trauma experiences. And I said, like, have you ever had nightmares or thought about an event or something that happened to you when you didn't want to? And she just like snapped into this panic attack. And I was like, hold up. Like, because, you know, I was just sitting there like bubbling stuff in as I was going. And, you know, it was kind of amazing to watch a true panic attack because we've had high levels of anxiety. And again, go back to our anxiety podcast if you want to kind of learn more about anxiety versus trauma. But anyway, she had a panic attack just thinking about thinking, essentially. And I was like, what? You know, because she clearly hadn't shared something with me. And so I learned that she had been raped like 3 weeks earlier. And I was like, oh, my goodness gracious, I would not have done it this way if I had known. And of course, we don't know because people aren't going to walk up and be like, hello, my name's Julie. I was raped yesterday. You know, that's not something we would do. And so, you know, that was really impactful for me, a great learning moment to be able to just, you never know what people are walking around with. And so, you know, I tried to prep better for other sessions. And so we got her stable because she was in a panic attack. Rides out about 10 minutes. That's the max. If it's more than that, you're really in just high levels of anxiety. A panic attack is short and intense, really not more than 10 minutes. Somebody I ran into said they had a 48-hour panic attack, and I was like,
"Oh man,
nope, incorrect, sorry." Of course, I didn't say that, but I was like, "Sounds like you had really high levels of anxiety, right?" So, but not a panic attack. Those are short and intense, and often you're not able to breathe or think. And like, if you were like, "Hello, which way?" They'd be like,
"I don't know."
Right? Not the time to ask questions. And so, you know, we went for a walk because change of scenery can be really impactful. And so we went for a walk, and she just, like, second we got outside, second panic attack. And I was like, oh, okay, here we go. You know, again, learning moment. I was like, this will be helpful. Let's change environment. But something about being outside was really scary. And I learned it's because the sexual assault took place right outside of her apartment building. And I was like, well, gosh darn it, I would not have taken you for a walk outside of the building. If I had known that, we would have stayed inside. Again, nothing really could have been different for either of us because this isn't something that we walk around with and share. So let's talk about symptoms here. So I mentioned nightmares and panic attacks.
So, you know, it's different for everybody. Individuals might avoid places, people, things that just remind them of the traumatic event that occurred. You already said they're reoccurring nightmares, but then that can in turn lead to an insomnia. Due to the fact, I mean, you know, you're scared to go to sleep. They can be easily startled, that severe anxiety comes into place. They can have detachment from others. It can be emotional or just socially. They don't want to, you know, be around people anymore. And one thing I think is always interesting that people don't realize, physical pain. I have an individual I work with, and I guess it's a quick story. It's actually a car accident he got into a couple years ago, and he has to get in the cars because he has to, you know, see his providers and whatnot. But he's very cautious on who he drives with. But he suffers from these extreme migraines, blurry vision, and just overall body aches. And it's not that it's from the car accident, they said, but just the PTSD just takes an extreme toll on his body.
Yeah, somatoform disorders. So the other thing is upset stomachs, especially in kids. Cause they maybe don't want to share.
Yeah.
You know, and so that manifests that way. And I'm sure we are all guilty of trying to pull this on our parents when we were younger, too. But like, my stomach hurts. But it was probably school anxiety.
Right.
Or just straight up lying. We were like, I'm going to stay home with the chicken noodle soup. And, you know, it's going to be great. But anyway, so, you know, it doesn't always look like what you think it looks like. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think we all have this image of, you know, probably a gentleman in like his army uniform with dirt all over his face, like rocking back and forth or something. And that's can happen. But that's definitely not the case, especially when we think about poverty. You know, I mean, just thinking about the neighborhoods people are in. Typically, lower income neighborhoods are going to have more crime, less resources. You know, you're more likely to witness scary things in that way. And then, of course, finances are stressful. Right. I think all of us, literally everybody, can probably relate.
Yes.
But yeah. So some other things that happen is that if you're going through stress, and we learned about how it changes your brain, it also lends itself to doing other things to compensate, because a lot of us don't want to acknowledge, because trauma is very scary. So we don't want to go to a therapist or to a doctor and talk about it, because then we got to talk about it, right? So people may choose to self-medicate, aka alcohol, marijuana, other drugs. It makes it all worse. Sorry. Don't do it if you can. I know it's hard. And then it also leads to other like risky behaviors and things of that nature. So driving too fast, a little bit of suicidality, of course. You know, if you're really feeling that loss of control and you haven't been able to gain a sense of control back, it's very dehumanizing. And so we might see some suicidality associated with that. Kirsty, our future therapist, is going to share treatments for us.
Okay, so this is just some examples. One is prolonged exposure therapy, and this is where with your therapist, you will expose yourself to the different thoughts, feelings, and situations that you have been avoiding in order to, you know, help yourself all around with, hopefully to get over it or have better ways to cope or handle it. Another therapy is cognitive processing therapy, which is where you will talk with your therapist and you'll fill out different worksheets about negative thoughts and beliefs that are upsetting you. This is kind of a lot like talk therapy, using your therapist as a resource. And then we have EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization. Can't say this word.
Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR.
Which is where your therapist will ask you to choose a memory from your trauma and identify the negative thoughts and emotions and feelings in your body that you will deal with. Another treatment for PTSD are different types of medications. SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and SNRIs, which are selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, are medications that can help raise your levels of the chemicals in your brain, which can help you feel better. And then there's also some cases where benzodiazepines may be needed.
And that's like Xanax. Mm-hmm. People are pretty familiar with Xanax. Yeah. So that's only useful if you're having panic attacks. And it's very addictive. So a lot of doctors don't want to prescribe it. I had a young lady that had PTSD, started taking Xanax, and then she started crushing it and snorting it. And I was like,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So you want to be very careful and mindful with benzodiazepines, especially. And you can crash if you stop taking it. Very addictive. Not a great plan. But it's very helpful, too. So I don't want to discount that. Okay, really quickly, we forgot to say in the biology section that not only does cortisol get passed down, but it also physically changes the structure of two parts of the brain. Do you wanna?
I believe it was the hypothalamus and the amygdala.
The hippocampus.
I lied.
So the hippocampus, which is responsible for your memory, so that I find that so fascinating because trauma will change the way you remember things forever. And so I look at it like sunglasses. Mm-hmm. And so now a lot of situations that are not associated with the traumatic event. So if you were in a car accident or whatever, and then you're talking to someone, your like fight or flight system is screwy. And so you're going to perceive a lot more stuff as threatening that isn't because of these sunglasses, mm-hmm. because your amygdala and your hippocampus have been altered in some way. And I thought it was interesting to share. And that also can potentially be passed genetically onwards. So really quickly, if you've heard of ACEs, they're like one of my favorite things to talk about. They're called adverse childhood experiences. There was this really neat study done by the CDC, so the Center for Disease Control, and Kaiser Permanente, which is a major health provider here in Maryland, but they actually did this, I think, in California. And so what they did is they made thousands of people take these questionnaires that were health-based and also included what they called adverse childhood experiences, which they broke into three categories, which were abuse, household challenges, and neglect. And so under abuse, the standard emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, and then in neglect, emotional or physical neglect. And then I find the household challenges so interesting. So you were around while your parents, your mother most likely, just because of what we know about statistics, but your mother was treated violently, perhaps by a father figure or a boyfriend or somebody else, but you were around while mom was treated violently. If your parents used substances unsafely, and so, you know, there's a difference between having a beer, you know, at a party and drinking a 6-pack or 12-pack every night, right? There's a history of mental illness in the family. So as we know, you guys have probably heard nature versus nurture. It is nature and nurture. It's a combination of both. And so not only do you maybe have the genetic passed down from your parents that would make you higher likelihood of experiencing it, you're also going to learn perhaps, depending on the situation and your parents' resilience, you may learn their way of looking at the world because they're the ones raising you. And if they have these sunglasses on and they teach you that talking to strangers is scary, which is normal to teach your children, but they go further and they're like, lock the doors, don't ever talk to anybody, then we've learned a different kind of behavior. Separation or divorce of the parents is also an adverse childhood experience. Mm-hmm. And then if anybody in the household has been incarcerated. And so they ask these, I think that's 10 questions. 1, 2, 3. Anyway, around 10 questions about this information. And then they looked at the physical health of the people. And this was a reflective exercise. So these people were all adults, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever. And they were asked, did any of these experiences happen to you before you were 18? And so, interestingly, I have the numbers for you. Mm-hmm. So the more ACEs you have, which sounds so wrong because ACE is normally a good thing, yeah. but in this case, it's not a good thing. So the more ACEs you have, the more likely you are to have lasting impacts. And I'll talk about those in a second. But for instance, so the number of people with zero ACEs, so they did not have abuse or any of those household challenges or neglect, was about 36%. So that means we're going to do some math here. Hold, please. 64% of people have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. And so that's staggering to think about, because I think we also like to just always loss of control, right? We always want to put that happens to other people because it's a self-protective measure. And so 26% of people had one ACE, 16% had two, about 10 had three, and then four or more was about 12% of the population. And so, you know, wow, right? And so some of those lasting impacts, just to scare y'all, all right? Traumatic brain injury, fractures, burns. So you were more likely to be physically hurt if you had more ACEs, right? And that kind of makes sense. We just talked about abuse. You're much more likely to have depression, anxiety, suicidal thinking, PTSD, surprise. You are more likely to become accidentally pregnant or unintended pregnancy. You are more likely to have your children die during pregnancy and miscarry. More likely to have STDs, HIV, cancer, diabetes, and lower education and occupational and income. So, right? I mean, when we think about that, so like 12% had four or more, which again, basically each level you go up ramps up your risk for all of these things. And it's really fascinating. The information is free online because the CDC and Kaiser are both really large organizations that can afford it. So if you want to look up the ACE, A-C-E study, you can find out a lot more information because that's one of my favorite things to talk about. It's so fascinating. Okay, so if you listen to this episode, now you're feeling traumatized because you are perceiving a threat to yourself and feel a loss of control, please call 1-800-273-8255 or TALK. So 1-800-273-8255 here in Howard County, 410-531-6677. If you go back to the National Suicide Hotline and you are a veteran, we were not putting you down this episode, to be very clear. If you are a veteran, if you boop one, that gets you a specific veteran support suicide hotline, which is great. And again, remember, these are not just for suicide. You can call at any time about pretty much anything. Probably don't ask them what's for dinner, but, you know, you can talk to them about any kind of stresses. Okay, so you've listened to us talk about all this scary stuff, and, you know, hopefully you are not feeling traumatized from listening to this. But what we do want to point out is that there is a comeback, so to speak, and that's resilience. And so resilience is your ability to bounce back or see through adversity. And most people think this is something you have or you don't. And certainly you are born with a level of resilience, but you can also train this in yourself. And so there's a lot of different ways you can do it. And so I really highly recommend that you go Google like how to improve resilience. You can take the brief resilience scale to find out where you're at right now. It's six questions, so it won't take you that long. And it's a really interesting kind of like self-reflective practice. Resilience is actually, I would say resilience is my favorite topic to talk about. That's what my dissertation is going to be on. And so I'm also open to questions. So if you are listening to this episode and you're like, what? Just email me. It's in the podcast description. And then our self-care challenge for today is recognizing how you react with stress. And so when I shared this with my guests, they both were like, how do I react with stress, right? So this is something that we don't often think about. And so I really encourage you the next time somebody is like, hello, Anita, you are stressed. You're going to be like, oh, am I? Cool. Let me think about what am I doing right now? Am I gritting my teeth? Am I bouncing my legs? Am I snapping at everybody? Am I biting my nails? So that's me. I bite my nails. It's horrible. I've tried literally my entire life. I can't stop it. But that's my first sign, typically. And my boyfriend is really good about being like, Julie, right? And I'm like, yes, hello. I am a confident adult that does not bite my nails. But what's great is when he does that, I will catch myself in my head thinking about something that's stressful, and I'll be like, oh. So I really recommend that you explore and try to find that out, because it's the first step to changing your habits, is recognizing what might be happening. So thank you for letting me go on my tangent about ACEs and resilience, and we really appreciate you guys listening. So again, please reach out if you have questions. I'm here as a resource. I answer pretty quickly, and thank you all for listening. Wishing you good mental health.
Connect with us We are Dragon Digital Radio.